and welcome to this week's edition of the Talking Newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. I'm Bill Redway and this is the Red Saturn programme for the week ending Saturday the 17th of August 2019. Now, I've just returned from a marvellous music festival in Devon, the Sidmouth Folk Festival, and the music I'm playing today is from a group of French-Canadian musicians called Le Vent du Nord, who came all the way from Quebec to play here. They've actually become quite well known amongst the folk cognoscenti in recent years, and it was great to have the opportunity to see them at Sidmouth. The track is called Cotillon du Capitaine. We are very grateful to Le Vent du Nord for allowing us to play this on our programme. The album is called Territoire, and as usual, I'll play the track in full at the end of the programme. This week, of course, we have the latest news stories from the current edition of the Hearts Advertiser, and follow that with suggested listings of programmes on national radio that might be of interest to you over the next 7 days. Courtesy of Sue, once again. In part two, we have an article from Hearts Life magazine about the Cairngorm reindeer herd owned and managed by the daughter of a Welland GP. And in part three, Rob Pearman and Debbie Heath discuss the novel Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders. We start with the news, and our readers today are Gilly, Caroline, Fiona and Liz.
Hello, I'm Caroline, and the first story I'm going to read about is how new hospital rules are hindering a mum visiting her ill newborn son. A Bricketwood mum is struggling to visit her seriously ill baby after the hospital imposed strict visiting rules over the school's summer holidays. When mum Karen Knock gave birth to baby Oliver, Knack Knocker, at the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital in May this year, she had little idea the difficulties that were about to be forced upon the family. At just 2 days old, the tiny newborn had his first operation to correct a rare defect where the oesophagus does not properly meet the stomach, called oesophageal atresia. Since then, he has had numerous other surgeries because of his vectoral association, including on his nose and heart, and Oliver is still in hospital. Vectoral is an acronym for all the different defects around the body: vertebral, anorectal, cardiac, tracheo-oesophageal, fistula oesophageal atresia, renal and limb. It is unclear what causes the disorder, which affects around 1 in 10,000 to 40,000 births. However, Chelsea and Westminster Hospital is currently undergoing redevelopment and has imposed rules on visiting hours in the neonatal intensive care and high dependency. In force for 10 weeks over the summer school holidays, no more than two people can visit a cot at any time, and one of those must be a parent. This means that Oliver's siblings, Brian Knack and Nathan Knocker, cannot visit together, and Karen or Dad Dashima Tony Knocker must accompany them. As Tony has to work and Karen cannot leave four-year-old Nathan by himself, the family are struggling to visit baby Oliver while he recovers. When Karen's friends at Howwood Primary School heard about the dilemma, they came together to raise money for childcare. Kerry Boswell, mum of Nathan's friend Willow, set up the fundraising page. She said, "It is so sad, and it is not something I have had to go through. We set up the fundraiser to help the family financials to take that pressure off their shoulders." A spokesman for the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital NHS Foundation Trust said, "We are always committed to providing the highest standards of care possible. We are in contact with the family to see how we can best support them, both to see the best care for their new baby and to provide care for the whole family."
Hello, my name's Jenny. Tributes to Second World War sergeant who was shot by the Nazis on paratrooping raid. Tributes have been paid to a St Albans special sergeant who was executed by Nazi soldiers during the Second World War. A former SAS soldier and anonymous author, writing under the pseudonym X Lance Corporal X, invited Frank Guest of Leyland Avenue in St Albans to a memorial for his uncle. Ex-Lance Corporal X discovered the brave acts of Sergeant Frank Ernest Terry Hall while researching a book called The SAS and LRDG Role of Honour. It's a three-volume text about the role of the SAS in eastern France, for which the author visited nearly every SAS soldier's grave. He found that in 1944, Sergeant Terry Hall and 15 fellow paratroopers landed in Vosges to sabotage the Nazis' roll and rail communications as part of Operation Leuthen. However, a very large contingent of German soldiers were tipped off that the SAS were nearby and, believing it was a larger group than it was, brought in sniffer dogs for the search. Although the French resistance offered food and shelter and refused to divulge the hiding places of the SAS group, the British soldiers were eventually rounded up and held prisoner at Maison Barthélemy in Moisy. According to the Telegraph, some 140 people living in Moisy were arrested by the Nazis because they sheltered the British soldiers. On September 20, 8 men in Sergeant Terry Hall's paratrooper group were driven in a lorry into the woods of Les Moisy, stripped of their uniforms and made to stand in a freshly dug grave. They were then shot in the back of the head, falling on top of the naked bodies of their comrades. This execution was against the Geneva Convention, which specified that prisoners of war should be protected from acts of violence. German soldiers did not abide by this because Führer Adolf Hitler had decreed that special forces were an exception. The last words of James Black, the final man shot in Sergeant Terry Hall's group, are thought to be, "I am a soldier." These crimes were revealed after the war ended. The bodies were moved to Dürnbach War Cemetery in Germany, and all those involved in the atrocity were brought to justice. Details did not come into the public domain, however, until many years later. Ex-Lance Corporal X said, 13 years ago, I answered a call to lay wreaths on a small group of wartime graves at one of the more inaccessible locations covered by this roll of honour. The headstones of the casualties concerned revealed that they had lost their lives after the fighting had moved on, although it was soon apparent that no one seemed to know why. Their stories had simply been lost over the intervening years. Initial research revealed that this was true of the majority of Second World War SAS casualties. Although no historian, my interest had been piqued, and I set about verifying or establishing facts by interviewing as many veterans as I could. The author contacted Sergeant Terry Hall's relatives, including his nephew Frank, to visit Sergeant Terry Hall's memorial. A coach took around 75 relatives to two memorial sites where there was an address in English and in French, a rendition of The Last Post, a performance of the two national anthems, and 2 minute silence. The group then visited various other sites of interest, including the Maison Barthélemy, the paratrooping drop zone, existing monuments, and where Sergeant Terry Hall and two others were captured. Frank said, "The whole event was very well organised, and it was extremely moving and emotional, standing on the same ground that my uncle and his men had stood 75 years ago in the service of their country. It showed the bravery of the SAS men, the loyalty of the French, and the inhumanity of the German SA troops and their commanders." And there's a picture here of Sergeant Terry Hall, looking very young and very brave.
Hi, I'm Liz. My first story is entitled MP Named Ally of Pubs After She Campaigned for Industry. St Albans MP Anne Main has received a trophy and title for being an ally to the pub industry. Mrs Main was named a beer champion by the British Beer and Pub Association because of her support for the Long Live the Local campaign. This lobbying group secured consecutive beer duty freezes and is now pushing for the fee to be cut in 2019. Along with other supportive MPs, Mrs Main was also given a tap handle trophy. She said, I am delighted to receive this award, and I must congratulate the British Beer and Pub Association for their long-running and successful campaign. Pubs are so important to the St Albans community, and I will continue to do everything I can to ensure they get the support they need from the government. I have had several meetings with government ministers in the Treasury and held debates in Parliament on the topic of support for pubs this year. I hope we now see some real action to support this important sector in the upcoming budget. This comes as a parallel campaign, Save UK Pubs, is pushing for a review of how business rates are calculated. A re-evaluation of the business rates formula in 2017 left St Albans pubs facing an average 72% hike. In last year's October budget, then Chancellor Philip Hammond announced a one-third discount for retail premises with a rateable value of £51,000. But this did not help 24 pubs in St Albans valued higher. The campaign was recently renamed Save UK Pubs to reflect its national significance. Campaign leader Sean Hughes said, "We are delighted that Anne has been given an award. Although the award is for a different campaign," he said, "Mrs. Main has thrown her back in behind the business rates issue as well." He said, "Business rates are now the most important and pressing issue in this industry, and if we don't do something about this in the next 2 years, we will have a serious problem in the high street. Everyone is under enormous pressure. The first thing it will result in is job cuts, and in the long run, it will result in more closures." This comes as a foraging pub in St Albans, the Verulam Arms, declared insolvency. It had faced an 104% business rates rise. And there's a picture enclosed in this article which shows Mrs. Main pulling a pint in ye olde fighting cocks with the landlord Christo Toffoli and Visit Hearts director David Curtis Brignall.
Hello, my name's Fiona, and my first article has the headline "Wildlife Habitat Development. Once the birds and insects, snails and flowers go, they are gone." A habitat for rare wildlife in Harpenden is inching another step closer to being developed. A planning application has been submitted to St Albans City and District Council for the design, layout and landscaping of 24 new homes on the former Westfield allotments in Beeching Close. Harpenden Town Council received outline planning permission for the scheme in October 2018 on the condition that this separate application was submitted for the appearance of the new builds. Campaigners have been contesting the project for years because the site is home to breeding birds, toads, frogs, slowworms, grass snakes and Roman snails, which are protected under the Wildlife and Countryside Act 1981. Harpenden Town Council commissioned investigation in April to May 2016 and May 2017 found at least 66 snails living on the space. Local campaigner Carol Hedges said, "It has wildlife on it. It has the highest count of these particular snails in the north of Hertfordshire, and they are preparing somewhere else to put them. It's absolutely ridiculous because they are territorial. It's like taking you out of your homes and dumping you somewhere else. It's disgraceful. Once all the insects and birds and flowers and snails are gone, they are gone." The space has not been used as allotments since 1999, and the new scheme includes 12 socially rented, 2 affordable rented and 10 shared ownership homes. Harpenden councillor Melanie Pridgeon said she sympathises with both sides, but stressed that the site has already received planning permission and been included in the Harpenden neighbourhood plan. "Whether it should or shouldn't have been in there, we can argue about, but the struggle is that it is going to be hard to stop any development on that site on that basis," she said. "Some of the issues raised could potentially be mitigated, but how the development is managed, such as access to the site. The thing is, what we really need in Harpenden is social housing, and I feel very strongly about that. I genuinely care about both sides. It is a site of wilderness that is totally unused at the moment and that is really hard to lose, but we need social housing as well." She said money from the development could be used to better Harpenden and address community issues. The land has been scrutinised for possible development for more than a decade, and planning permission was initially sought by Harpenden Town Council for a scheme in 2005. That was for 42 flats on the site, but it was refused by St Albans Council at the time. Another application to build 20 affordable homes on the land was rejected in 2010 because the access path crossed over part of the cycle network. Then in 2013, Harpenden Town Council had to abandon plans to construct an access road next to the site because of backlash against dumping excavated soil into the habitat. A MenCap scheme to build homes for people with learning disabilities was dashed in 2014 when the charity decided the space was too small to provide the necessary number of homes. When MenCap pulled out, Harpenden Town Council reverted back to its original plan to build affordable housing. The current project's outline planning permission was submitted by Harpenden Town Council, but the authority has since put the work out for tender and the project is now being progressed by the Lee Valley Developments. Harpenden Mayor Councillor Brian Ellis said, "This application for reserved matters has been submitted on behalf of the housing association that we are working with to build the development. It is not a town council application." St Albans Council is due to make a decision on the site by October the 10th. Lee Valley Homes is the development subsidiary of Alderwick Housing Group, and a spokesman said, "The development will provide much needed affordable homes for local people in an area where house prices are high and where it's especially hard to get on the housing ladder." On the Roman snail issue, they said, "We take our responsibilities to the environment seriously and sensitively and have undertaken an ecology and snail reptile migration strategy. As part of this, we're relocating the Roman snails to a suitable habitat that has been identified in Shillington."
Next to a photograph of Sandridge High Street is the headline, "Have Your Say on New Neighbourhood Plan for Sandridge." Residents are being asked for their views on an emerging neighbourhood plan for part of the St Albans district. A consultation on the draft Sandridge Parish Neighbourhood Plan is open until September the 27th, with a drop-in viewing event on August the 17th. The proposals, which have been drafted after earlier consultations with residents, include numerous policies covering transport, housing and the environment. It looks to restrict development to small-scale housing and within the existing village boundary, create more affordable housing and completely preserve any greenbelt not already included in the St Albans City and District Council local plan. One of the policies relates to the Oakland College site, potentially expanding from 348 to 1,200 homes. Should the East St Albans Broad location be adopted within the local plan, this policy sets out criteria to ensure the development makes a positive contribution to the entire community, rather than becoming a dormitory commuter estate. If the plan is approved by referendum, the District Council are obliged to consider it in all planning applications. The Neighbourhood Plan Working Group said, "Changes are inevitable, but we can try to manage changes to improve how we and others in our community live and work. One major way we can do that is through a neighbourhood plan, which will cover the period 2019 to 2036. The aim is to describe the changes we want to see as well as those we don't. This will then guide council officers for both Sandridge Parish Council and St Albans District Council when deciding on applications for development and planning permission." In February last year, the Harpenden Neighbourhood Plan was approved by 4,490 votes at referendum. The Sandridge Parish consultation event will take place on Saturday, August the 17th, between 2 p.m. and 5 p.m. at Sandridge Village Hall. Comments on the document will be reviewed after September the 2nd, before it is submitted to the District Council.
My next article is entitled Trekkers' Gratitude for the Kindness of Strangers. Strangers from around the country were overwhelmingly generous to a St. Albans chef completing a charity trekking challenge. Ben Garcia walked nearly 900 miles from John of Groats in Scotland to Land's End in Cornwall throughout May to August in aid of the Mental Health Foundation. He smashed his goal of £2,000 by raising more than £3,300 for the charity, which is working to achieve the same progress for mental health as the medical profession has in physical health. The 28-year-old was surprised by the kindness of strangers along the way, who offered accommodation, money, meals, and friendly conversation without expecting anything in return. One offer of hotel, bed, and board came from a woman who read a previous Haas Ad article about Ben's challenge, which was published in May. Ben said, "It was a real adventure. It was a lot of things. It was highs and lows. It was mentally and physically demanding, but it was really rewarding. I met all these amazing people, and I think one of the things that took me by surprise was I thought that people were going to be my biggest danger. But actually, they helped me the most. As soon as I told people about what I was doing, it allowed them to open up and give. And everyone was giving. It was totally overwhelming. I can't do anything but be thankful. I couldn't do anything in return." Carrying a 12-kilo rucksack, Ben hiked around 20 miles a day on average and was sometimes accompanied by friends and family who joined him for sections of the walk. He said, "It was great. You could talk to somebody and have that support. It broke up the routine of how I walked, but it was nice to share the experience with someone." Ben thanked his wife Danielle for her support. "I wouldn't have been able to do this if Dee hadn't supported me, because even though you are by yourself, Dee was always at the end of the phone when things got hard." Having been travelling and working as a chef for about a decade, Ben plans to move to the US with Danielle in the future. There are four splendid pictures with the beautiful views in the background of Ben, with his walking poles, his very grand glasses, hat, and of course, the rucksack.
Neighbours come together in big push for war memorial. A group of neighbours have banded together to propose the construction of a First World War street memorial. Despite having nearly the highest number of losses during the First World War in St Albans, King's Road is located outside the Abbey Parish, which meant that it didn't have a memorial monument following the 1918 armistice. Now a group of residents, including Alison and Dave Comley, hope to change this. "We are hoping to link the past with the present and bring these men to life," Alison explained. They are putting out an appeal for information about many of these men, whose names are listed below, in order to create a publication detailing the lives of the soldiers. With enough information, they would like to put on an exhibition too. Contact has already been made between the King's Road group and the great niece of Fred Henry, who died in October 1916. The War Office gave his parents permission and help in travelling to France to see their son in hospital. 2 weeks later, Fred succumbed to his wounds and passed away in Boulogne Hospital. The fund would like to reach out to further relatives of King's Road residents who died between 1914 and 1918 in order to find out whatever they can about the men who so bravely gave their lives during the war.
Exhibition explores the art of grieving through work. A group of artists are coming together for a special exhibition to share artwork that has been shaped by bereavement and loss. The Art of Grieving exhibition takes place in St Albans next month and will include works in a variety of media, including paintings, photographs, the written word, sculptures, textiles and collage. Every exhibit is the work of someone touched by loss who has used their own creative processes to express their grief and to work through the emotions they have experienced as a result of bereavement. The exhibition will be at Kingsbury Barn in Branch Road, St Albans, on Saturday and Sunday, September the 7th and 8th, and is supported by Rennie Grove Hospice Care. The charity has recently launched a bereavement support line, which offers a confidential and safe way to seek help after the loss of a loved one. Rennie Grove is also well known for offering care and support for children and adults across Hertfordshire who have been diagnosed a life-limiting illness, and their services extend to the patients' families and carers too. The curator of the exhibition, Katie Ray, explains that this is a unique exhibition and it offers a different forum for people to talk or think about bereavement and loss while appreciating the immensely personal works of art from 25 different artists. Contributing artist Katerina Petit Van Hooy, whose 22-year-old daughter Kiama died suddenly from a form of sepsis in 2012, said, "I found that the process of creating and giving visual expression to my loss and grief greatly helped me in coming to terms with the death of my daughter." Stuart Marks, Chief Executive of Rennie Grove Hospice Care, said, "We are very pleased to be supporting the second Art of Grieving exhibition. The artist that exhibited in the first exhibition in 2017 said that it was beneficial to them to express their grief using a range of artistic means, and we are looking forward to being able to share these with local people whilst helping to promote contributing artists too. We do hope to see you there." The Art of Grieving exhibition will be open from 11 to 4 on both the days, and entry is free of charge.
A buddy-up scheme has been launched to tackle Auburn Way crime. Safety-conscious residents say they now feel unable to navigate a crime-ridden footpath between St Albans and Hatfield alone. Following a recent crime spate along the Auburn Way, a petition was submitted to St Albans City and District Council asking for CCTV cameras and lighting along the stretch. Despite reaching about 1,200 signatures, it was decided there was no pressing need and the former railway track remains unlit and secluded. Sarah Tomlin has now set up a Facebook group enabling people to run or walk along the pathway in pairs or small groups. She thought up the idea, called Auburn Way Buddy Up, after she was the victim of an unprovoked attack. The Hatfield local was running down the Auburn Way at about 7:45 a.m. on August the 11th when a cyclist punched her in the back. A spokesman from Hearts Police said the man was wearing all black and carrying a black rucksack. Sarah said it was a massive impact. It looked like he was about to slow down, but then he went down one of the side lanes. I was thinking, why do I now have to feel fearful going for a run in a really nice place? Teacher Sarah is convinced the blow was not accidental. The speed and the space he had to go around me, he did it for the sheer fun of it, or maybe he was trying to grab my belt with my phone. He didn't slow down or turn around. If it was accidental, most people would stop and say sorry. It wasn't an accident. Sarah is training to run the Royal Parks Half Marathon in October and hoping to raise £370 for Kidney Care UK. It is a course close to Sarah's heart because her partner, Lee Rusby, has Burgess disease. He has to endure dialysis every day and is on the waiting list for a kidney transplant. Sarah only found out about the notoriety of Auburn Way after the incident. "I'm glad I didn't know about the crimes until now. I feel quite vulnerable and threatened, and it makes me feel nervous to be on the path alone." The group has proved to be a hit already, with more than 130 people already signed up. Sarah stressed that she has not finessed the finer details and is planning on a preliminary meet-up of interested people.
Dead of Hiroshima remembered. The dead of Hiroshima were remembered in a special ceremony which saw St Albans' campaign for nuclear disarmament reinforce its commitment to the abolition of nuclear weapons. Paper doves, on which were written messages of peace, were attached to railings in St Peter Street, above a banner proclaiming, "No more Hiroshimas," on the day after the 74th anniversary of the bombing of the Japanese city by the United States in 1945. The Hiroshima bombing on August 6th and the subsequent attack on Nagasaki on August 9th killed between 129,000 and 226,000 people, most civilians, and remains the only use of nuclear weapons in armed conflict. David Lee, chairman of St. Albans Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, said, "People are worried about climate change and other environmental issues, quite right too, but we should remember that nuclear weapons pose just as big a threat to humanity. We say, unless we get rid of nuclear weapons, one day they will get rid of us." And there's a picture of David Lee with his Ban the Bomb t-shirt and the various messages and pictures of doves on the railings in St. Peter Street.
Men in Lycra ride to success for Home Starts Hertfordshire. 10 local cycling enthusiasts, including the so-called Men in Lycra, completed the flagship London to Surrey 100-mile Prudential Ride London Challenge and raised £10,000 for charity Home Start Hertfordshire. Half of the team were known as Men in Lycra and consisted of members of St Albans Chamber of Commerce, including Paul Rosenthal, Sales Director of Amthal Fire and Security, Mark Bunting of Aitchison Rafferty, and Andrew Williamson of WMT Chartered Accounts. Together, the entire team headed to the London Festival of Cycling to raise critical funds for Home Start Hertfordshire and enable the charity to reach out to more families seeking their support. Susie Moody, Strategic Manager for Home Start Hertfordshire, said, "We are so proud of all of our Prudential cyclists. They've not only completed what was a really tough challenge, but have also raised an incredible amount of money, which is still rising. We could not deliver our service without support from the local community and businesses, so we are extremely grateful to all the guys and those who have sponsored them." Paul Rosenthal added, "The ride was amazing. From start to finish, the crowds lined the streets, cheering us on, and making us feel like true celebrities as we cycled round. Reaching the Mall and then riding down it was truly breathtaking, and seeing the Queen Victoria Memorial ahead was the perfect ending. We're delighted we've managed to complete the course and raise so much money for such an important local charity. Many parents need help, advice and support during those early years and as children grow up. There is no rule book for raising a family, and sometimes it can seem overwhelming, particularly if your family is going through difficult times. Home Start is essential to help so many families at such a critical time. Home Start is a self-funded charity that supports families with young children who are feeling unable to cope. In Hertfordshire alone, it has helped 269 families and 707 children across the county, with approximately 80 families still waiting for support, 11 of which are in the St Albans area. If you would like to support Home Start Hertfordshire, please visit the dedicated fundraising page at virginmoneygiving.com.
Changes to bus service cause residents uproar. Concerns over road safety and the well-being of trees have prompted a group of residents to object to bus route changes. Residents of Verulamium Estate are unhappy about the imposed introduction of a new route for the S7, S8 and S9 services. Currently, the buses travel around the estate in a circular route along Main Avenue, but the County Council is planning to reverse the clockwise direction of travel. This £100,000 project has led to a number of concerns, especially focused on safety, loss of mature trees and the lack of consultation. Residents claim that the most serious adverse ecological impact would be the loss of trees. Several mature trees lining Main Avenue are to be felled to make way for the new bus stops and the extra footways needed. Resident and former Police Chief Superintendent Dr. Robert Waring said, "The safety issue is our number one concern. Some bus stops have been positioned too close to road junctions and too near sharp bends in the road. Residents who are very familiar with the area fear that stationary buses in such locations will cause obstruction and seriously restrict vision for other drivers, also masking traffic and be a potential accident risk. Lack of consultation has also been a major source of contention. Robert said, "Many locals had no idea this scheme was happening until the work actually started. Even then, it was mainly just rumours. Only by walking the route and seeing the curbside markings for the new stops could you see exactly what was planned." He added, "If only local residents had been properly consulted about what they required and where to position the bus stops, all this 11th hour wrangling could have been avoided." Liberal Democrat County Councillor Sandy Walkington said, "The bus currently goes the wrong way round the estate, so all the stops are on the other side of the road from where people live. The County Council has a budget to improve the service and make it more accessible for disabled and less mobile people. We have consulted very heavily and the County Council are going to replace the trees."
Did you know there were nearly 2,000 calls to the RSPCA last year by people who were worried about cats in Hertfordshire? The animal charity puts many of the 1,839 calls down to moggies stuck in tight spots. But some are cats being abandoned, neglected or abused. RSPCA's cat welfare expert Alice Potter said, "Cats end up needing our help in a variety of reasons. For example, their natural curiosity can mean they need rescuing when they get into scrapes and tricky situations. There are also some real issues that we see time and time again, including cats and kittens being abandoned, cats having unplanned and unwanted pregnancies due to a lack of neutering, and multi-cat households where breeding has sadly become out of control. Every cat is an individual, but there are some signs that we can look out for to see how our cats are feeling through understanding their body language and behaviour to ensure they are happy and healthy." A separate article talks about the Addiction Centre refurbishment. A Hearts-based charity has completed refurbishment to its Addiction Treatment Centre thanks to a Tesco grant of almost £4,000. The Living Room has provided award-winning therapy to addicts since May 2000, aiming to break the generational cycle of addiction, with its centres in Stevenage, St Albans and Watford. In November 2017, the charity was awarded £3,900 through Tesco's Bags of Help initiative, a grant scheme launched by the supermarket giant in 2016 to fund community projects. Since then, the Living Room has used the money to redecorate their counselling rooms and purchase seating for all 484 of its members. The charity's fundraising manager, Mike Wiseman, said, "Our group therapy sessions really are such an important part of the recovery process. Thanks to Tesco, we have been able to provide a soothing and comfortable environment for our members."
My last piece this week has a really cheerful picture of a group of young people in shorts and holiday gear lined up and having a big smiley photograph. This is the young National Citizen Service volunteers from schools in St Albans, and they created a cookbook to help families in need. The national programme is delivered locally by Hearts County Council for young people aged between 15 and 17. As part of the programme, the volunteers have to undertake a social action project and chose to support the charity Home Start Hearts. They decided to create a recipe ebook focusing on low-cost, healthy and nutritious meals, with ideas that Home Start could use for the charities it supports. Working in teams, the group researched the nutritional value of recipes, cooked, tested and photographed them. Home Start strategic manager Susie Moody said, "When we visited, it was amazing. The group was so enthusiastic and passionate about what they were doing. Once the project is finished, the recipe book will be available on the Home Start website."
Three opera gems make their way to Park Hall in Harpenden next weekend. Irrational Theatre returns to the Leighton Road venue on Saturday, August the 24th, to present Samuel Barber's beautiful A Hand of Bridge, Peter Reynolds' Guinness World Records shortest opera, The Sands of Time, and Jacques Offenbach's delightful Le 66. In A Hand of Bridge, two married couples play a game of bridge during which their innermost desires are hilariously revealed. With music by Peter Reynolds and libretto by Simon Rees, The Sands of Time received the Guinness World Record for the world's shortest opera when it was composed in 1933. This 3.5-minute score follows married couple Stan and Flo, whose luck changes during the boiling of their breakfast egg. The three comic operas will be sung in English. The running time is approximately 75 minutes, with the price £15, including a glass of wine or soft drink. For tickets, visit www.ticketsource.co.uk/mytickets.
And now news of an organ recital. There's another Sunday afternoon recital in St Albans Cathedral's renowned Harrison and Harrison organ this weekend. Visitors to the Abbey on Sunday, August the 18th, will be able to hear Tom Wimpenny, the Assistant Master of the Music of St Albans Cathedral, play from 3 o'clock. His programme includes works by Mozart and two jazz-inspired pieces by distinguished British composer Peter Dickinson and American composer Henry Martin. Also included is an atmospheric piece by celebrated French composer Olivier Messiaen, which Tom has recorded on one of 5 CDs for the Naxos label devoted to the composer's music. Andrew Lucas, the master of the music, said, "Organ music continues to play an integral part in the life of the cathedral and throughout the city through the biennial International Organ Festival. These Sunday recitals, given by the cathedral's resident organists, provide the opportunity to hear a full-length organ concert, demonstrating the versatility the cathedral's wonderfully restored organ in some of the greatest works of the organ repertoire." Sunday's recital will last around 60 minutes, and a retiring collection will be taken towards the works of the Cathedral Music Department. Admission is free. The recital is not suitable for small children. Further concerts in the series take place on Bank Holiday Monday, August the 26th at 1 p.m, when Stephen Tharp from the United States of America will be performing. And there will be another concert on Sunday, September the 8th at 3 p.m.
We're now going to give you some information about the radio listings from Saturday the 17th of August to Friday the 23rd of August. Firstly, on Saturday the 17th of August, the BBC prom season is well underway, and this week's listing will give brief details of each day's concert, which are broadcast on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. Tonight's concert is an all-Russian programme with the London Philharmonic Orchestra and pianist Alexander Gindin, featuring the music of Rimsky-Korsakov, Rachmaninoff, Lindov and Glazunov. At 8 p.m. on Radio 4, Grace Dent presents the Untold Storytelling Festival and leads a discussion about modern storytelling on radio and television, with guests including Jed Mercurio, creator of TV drama Line of Duty. This is the Radio Times Pick of the Week. Quentin Tarantino's movie Mixtape on Radio 2 at 9 p.m. is the writer-director's pick of music from his extensive personal collection, which he has featured in his movies, and he discusses anecdotes about some of the films in which these pieces have been revived. Again at 9 p.m, but on Classic FM, Perfect Pitch with Karthi Genasaganaram explores the sporty side of classical music with guests Andy Murray and David Gower. For Sunday the 18th of August, The Reunion on Radio 4 FM at 11:15 is a new series with Sue McGregor returning to look back with guests at the York Minster Fire of 1984. On Radio 4 FM at 12:30 p.m. is the first of a series of 2 episodes of The Food Programme. 20 years after his TV series, the naked chef Jamie Oliver talks to Sheila Dillon about 2 tumultuous decades dominating food on TV and online. He also reveals where it all went wrong with his restaurant chain. The BBC prom concert tonight is by the Ulster Orchestra with BBC Radio 3 new generation artist Mariam Batsashvili playing violin in works by Beethoven, Clara Schumann and Shostakovich. On Radio 2 at 9pm, Richard Littlejohn pinpoints years in which he feels changed Britain politically, culturally and musically. He continues his series of The Years That Changed Britain Forever with input from former Sun editor Kelvin McKenzie, Nigel Farage, former MP and Home Secretary Alan Johnson, and Radio 2 presenter Joe Wiley.
A look now at programmes that run on each day through the week from Monday. The Book of the Week on Radio 4 FM at 9:45am is Coventry, a collection of essays by Rachel Cusk in which she weaves observations of domestic concerns with art, psychology and current affairs. In this first instalment, she contemplates the tourists, the Sunday drivers and the speed freaks that she meets in the country roads near her home. The 15-minute drama on Radio 4 at 10:45am is The Country Girls. This is a dramatisation in 10 instalments by Lynn Coghlan of Edna O'Brien's debut 1960 novel set in 1950s rural Ireland, where Kate and Baba, girls who occupy twin poles of romance and idealism, have been friends forever. The programme is repeated at 7:45pm. Radio 3 is highlighting the Edinburgh International Festival, with concerts from the Queen's Hall in Edinburgh at 11am. On Radio 4 at 12:04pm, Heartburn is the witty autobiographical work by novelist, director and Oscar-nominated screenwriter Nora Ephron, born 1941, died 2012. Published in 1983 and based on her marriage and divorce to Washington Post reporter Carl Bernstein. This abridged version by Antonio Hodgson is read by Juliana Jenkins and is repeated at 10:45pm. On Radio 4 at 1:45pm there is a new series, World War II, The Economic Battle. Duncan Weldon examines the economies of major countries involved in the run-up to the Second World War. The full works concerts run every evening on Classic FM at 8pm. Radio 4 has another new series of 10 episodes entitled Beyond Today at 11:30pm. These are podcasts in which a team focuses on a major news story, hearing from the BBC's global network of reporters and guests. The composer of the week is Joseph Bolaño's Chevalier de Saint-Georges, 1748-1799. This week, these programmes begin on Tuesday through to Friday at 1pm on Radio 3.
And some picks for each day from Monday to Friday. For Monday the 19th of August, veteran Labour politician Peter Hain joins Peter Hennessy to reflect on his life and career in Reflections on Radio 4 at 9am. On Radio 3 at 1pm, there is a live recital from the Cadogan Hall in London of Proms Chamber Music, featuring soprano Louise Alder and pianist Gary Matthewman, with songs by Schubert, Rossini, Chopin and Mendelssohn. The BBC Proms concert from the Royal Albert Hall on Radio 3 at 7:30pm is by the BBC Symphony Orchestra and Chorus and features Beethoven's Ninth Symphony together with premieres of commissioned works by Jonathan Dove and Dieter Ammann. For Tuesday the 20th of August at 9am on Radio 4, Stephen Fry continues his series of Fry's English Delight with The Doolittle Factor, which looks at various aspects of language with an assessment of whether it can be used by animals. He talks to experimenters who have claimed significant successes and with zoologists and linguists. The BBC Proms concert, live from the Royal Albert Hall on Radio 3 at 7:30pm, is by the London Symphony Orchestra and Chorus, conducted by Sir Simon Rattle, and features works by Kirklin, Vass and Walton. On Radio 4 at 8pm, journalists Peter Taylor and Fergal Keane share their experiences of reporting on the Northern Ireland conflict in Troubles Shared. For Wednesday the 21st of August, at 9am on Radio 4 in A Singer's Guide to Britain, Roderick Williams continues to tell the stories of Britain through song. This time, he looks at what the places where we choose to sing can tell us about our social history. This programme is repeated at 9:30pm. Still on Radio 4 at 9:30am in For Thought, Dr. Mark Williams presents his reasons for preserving the traditional GP home visit to a live audience, recorded at the WOMAD Festival in Wiltshire in July, as he thinks it plays a vital part in the delivery of good healthcare.
The BBC World Service is covering the subject of climate change and the farming industry in The Compass at 1:30pm and 10:05pm. Young farmers around the world have different methods for balancing commercial food production with our increasingly fragile natural environment. Anna Jones compares farms in Iowa, United States, and Ghana, where techniques are very different. Only time will tell who's got it right. The BBC Proms concert, live from the Royal Albert Hall on Radio 3 at 7:30pm, is a celebration of the enormously versatile work of singer Nina Simone. Jules Buckley conducts the Metropole Orchestra with singers Ledisi and Lisa Fisher. For Thursday the 22nd of August, the BBC World Service at 9:05am and 12:05am has a thought-provoking programme, The Forum. It's presented by Bridget Kendall on the subject of Imhotep, the ancient Egyptian mortal who became a deity and was immortalised in the film The Mummy. The discussion focuses on how he came to such prominence. Radio 4 Longwave and Radio 5 Live Sports Extra Digital are covering the first day of the third Ashes Test match between England and Australia from 10:30am to 7pm approximately. The BBC Prom Live from the Royal Albert Hall at 7:30pm features Elgar's Cello Concerto, played by a celebrated cellist, Sheku Kenne Mason, with the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. For Friday the 23rd of August, it's the second day of the third Ashes Test match, and that will continue on Radio 4 Longwave and Radio 5 Live Sports Extra Digital from 10:30am again to 7 o'clock approximately. The BBC Prom Live from the Royal Albert Hall at 7:30pm features the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra with works from Bach culminating in the mighty Bruckner's Eighth Symphony. Friday night is Music Night on Radio 2 at 8pm. The BBC Concert Orchestra is celebrating the 60th anniversary of the Motown record label. Guest singers Tommy Blaze and Heather Small cover big hits from The Supremes, Marvin Gaye, Smokey Robinson, Stevie Wonder and many others.
Hello, my name is Leslie. I'm going to read an article from Hertfordshire Life about a Hearts GP's daughter who ended up as a reindeer herder in Scotland. Meet Tilly Smith, who swapped village life in Wellin for the wilds of the Highlands. Tilly Smith is besotted by reindeer. She owns Britain's only free-ranging herd, more than 150 strong, in the Cairngorm Mountains of Scotland. With a GP father and a brother who has taken over the practice, medicine may have been the obvious career route for this 59-year-old, but it was her father's other keen interest, as a self-taught and in-demand deer expert, he advised and helped his estate managers and scientists, that lit a fuse. Our childhood was immersed in natural history, Tilly explains. My dad, Oliver Danzy, was a doctor in Wellin, and his passion was deer. He passed on his interest to me. I first studied the little muntjac that you find in the Hertfordshire woods. My dad used to be presented with many a live deer, one we hand-reared. She studied for a degree in zoology at the University of Bristol and learned of the reindeer herd which has roamed the 10,000-acre Cairngorms National Park since 1952. The Hurt was the brainchild of Dr. Ethel Lindgren and her husband, Michael Utsi, who kept Swedish mountain reindeer. It may seem far-fetched, but reindeer were once native to Britain, with the last wild reindeer recorded here in the medieval period. Tilly volunteered to help the project as a fresh graduate in the summer of 1981. It was a decision that would change her life in more ways than one. I got in touch with Dr. Lindgren and ended up in Scotland. The keeper, Alan, wasn't bad-looking, so I married him. Falling in love with both the keeper and the reindeer, Tilly never looked back. Tying the knot in 1983, she moved up to the Highlands, and the couple bought the herd in 1988, following the death of Dr. Lindgren. Michael died in 1979. The couple have two children, Fiona and Alex, who are also both involved in the business. And there is now a third generation, 10-month-old Hamish, Alex's son. What was it about the herd that initially pulled on Tilly's heartstrings, taking her from the little woods and fields of the Welland countryside to the subarctic Cairngorms? I love seeing the reindeer ranging on the mountainside in their natural environment, free to come and go as they please. But I also really enjoy handling the reindeer, haltering them, leading them off the hill, and training them to harness for Christmas. The males help to generate income and awareness of the herd by pulling sleighs on a UK tour of Christmas festivals each year. They are incredibly quiet, trusting animals and always a joy to work with. But when the wind and rain is driving in your face on the hill, it can be hard work. While the weather can be challenging, she says she would never leave. If you came up here, you wouldn't think you were attached to the rest of Great Britain. It's wild and it's expansive and just beautiful. We get a lot of people who come from quite built-up urban areas and they just love the solitude. Obviously, we have to cope with the long, dark nights in winters. We may have our first snowfall in September, heralding the wintertime, which is, of course, when the reindeer absolutely do their best. The animals all have different characteristics, explains Tilly. Some are very docile, trusting and generally friendly. Some are greedy, others shy. None of them are dangerous. Their tameness comes from thousands of years of domestication. Most reindeer are a brown-grey colour, but they can be jet black or even pure white. And each reindeer produces its own unique shaped antlers, which are shed each year and regrow the same way. We have had reindeer that only grow one antler. The most recent is Merrick, a young bull. He's a bit lopsided, laughed Tilly. The calves are named on a different theme each year. These have included trees, cakes, biscuits, even creepy crawlies. This year, the calves will be named after fictitious detectives. We don't name the reindeer after Father Christmas ones. They are immortal. Does she have a favourite? It was Olympic, a big, strong, dark-coloured Christmas reindeer. He seemed to seek out my company when he was young. I suspect because the bigger reindeer bullied him. He was a bit of a mummy's boy. But then he got a bit aloof and now he's the bully. So now, my favourite is Atlantic, who is 4 years old. He is a beautiful reindeer with lovely shaped antlers and very tame. And do they ever sell them? Absolutely not. They are born in the herd and die in the herd. While it's a love affair for Tilly, the real purpose of the herd is education. The site's visitor centre allows people of all ages to engage with the animals, to get up close and learn about their lives. Some people think the antlers are made of wood, and one gentleman said to me he thought reindeer were mythical creatures and only found in storybooks. The key role of education is also the driver for Tilly's writing on the species. The author of several books, her latest, Reindeer, An Arctic Life, has just been published. Although the reindeer live in the wild, they are domesticated, much like ponies. The wonderful thing about reindeer is the one minute you can be handling them, haltering them, and travelling away from home, and the next minute you can put them back on the mountain and they'll look after themselves. They are amazing animals. When man domesticated cows, sheep and goats, he fenced them in. But with reindeer, you can't do that. They need to move. It's still the case today up in Russia and Scandinavia. The herders live by their reindeer, but they also have to accept that the reindeer migrate and move, and we semi-accept that here. Part of the herd are always on the move, wandering around, and part of them are in a fenced area. I know 150 sounds a lot, but we have tabs on all of them. We know them individually by name. We know their characters. When you meet the herd, you're meeting a group of individuals. It's not just the family. We have dedicated staff who day in, day out talk reindeer. We're all nutters, really. Tilly is shortly to fly out to Kamchatka, the most easterly point of Russia. All my holidays are busman's holidays. I want to experience reindeer herding in different countries. With all the Smiths, mum, dad, son and daughter, dedicated to the herd, the legacy of Tilly's father's interest in deer has been a powerful one. She recalls a conversation with an indigenous reindeer herder. A Swedish Sami said to Alex, "You are the first Scottish indigenous reindeer herder." And so is his sister, Fiona. In a sense, a tribe has to start somewhere, and I suppose in some small way that tribe has started.
I'm here with Debbie Heath, and this time I'm not going to be talking with her about a book that she's chosen, but a book that I've chosen. So the onus is on me. And I was thinking, because she asked me why I chose this book or how I came to choose this book, I was actually looking back at the winners of the Man Booker Prize over the last few years, and I realised that actually we hadn't covered any of the authors who won that prize.
Right.
Since then, we've dealt with Hilary Mantel, because, of course, Wolf Hall won and then Bring Up the Bodies won, and she has yet to produce her third volume, which will probably go on and win a prize as well. So we've dealt with that one. Camilla Chester came in and talked about Hilary Mantel and those books. And I looked at the others and I thought, well, I know Peter Carey, I know a few other ones. I don't know anything about this one. George Saunders, Lincoln in the Bardo. And I thought, well, that's a very strange title for a start. When I got the book and I looked at it, I thought, crikey, what have I done? Because it is a very strange layout. I mean, it starts with 2.5 pages or thereabouts of a sort of a monologue by one character, but it then immediately shifts into what becomes standard throughout the book of a series of extracts from, there are two types of things. There's the historical side, because we are talking about President Lincoln.
Yes.
Abraham Lincoln. We're talking about, there's no surprise in this, I'm not giving anything away. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the sickness and then death of his young 11-year-old son, Willie, and the sadness that that brings, obviously, to Abraham Lincoln at a time when he is involved in the early stages of the Civil War. And people turn on him for this reason and say, you know, you don't understand all the people that are dying because of you, who pursued the Civil War, as it were, in order to free the slaves. It was more complicated than that, I admit. But in the sections that are dealing with the historical context, where we're looking at what was going on, it was in the White House, not the White House as we know it today, with the building that was there then. And there are extracts from other books.
The terror and consternation of the presidential couple may be imagined by anyone who has ever loved a child and suffered that dread intimation common to all parents, that fate may not hold that life in as high a regard and may dispose of it at will.
In Selected Civil War Letters of Edwin Willow, edited by Constance Mays.
So it's building up a theoretical story of the actual facts. Lincoln and his wife in the White House. There's a party, major, one of the great parties in the White House. At that time, his son is upstairs, effectively dying. And you get all sorts of historical extracts that describe that situation. And then it switches, and gradually, once it switches, the switch takes over to the graveyard, where there are characters of whom we know nothing other than what they tell us. And they are in what is called the Bardo. This is in the Bardo. It's like purgatory. It's like the limbo land. It's between death and moving forward beyond death into the next world. And they aren't there. They're stuck in this spirit land, which is where young Lincoln is in the beginning. And the characters develop. Well, they've got various characteristics, and there are lots and lots of them. It's an audiobook with 16 different actors. I think some of those 16 are doing more than one voice as well, because there are lots and lots of different characters that come pouring in. And it builds a wonderful picture. This is rather less a discussion than a monologue at the moment. I'm going to stop in a moment. But it's not a fantasy. It's fantastical. It's magical. I became totally engrossed by it. I thought when I looked at it at first, I can't cope with this. It looks so odd. How can you read a book which you may get three lines and then a quote and then three lines and then somebody says, where that's come from? And so the whole thing just, for me, builds and builds and builds. I couldn't put it down. And listening to the audiobook, which I found even more magical, although it has disadvantages, which we can perhaps talk about, the comparison between the two, I found that just rolled along. I mean, it feels like it goes on forever, and yet it doesn't. It's actually quite short by comparison with many books. That's why I picked it.
Okay.
Now, what did you make of it?
Well, it's really interesting. This is the first time I've seen the book. Obviously, I can't read the words, but I can see how it has been laid out. And I can tell you there is no way I would have read it ordinarily, but I can't see properly, so it all has to be done by audio. And that's a blessing and a curse. One of the difficulties is that sometimes an audiobook, which I listen to through my iPod, you don't get a blurb. You don't really know what it's about. So all I knew was this was a book definitely about Abraham Lincoln, not a historical political figure I was particularly interested in, but I thought, I'm interested in history, let's give it a go. And it was very confusing to start with, but once I got into the swing of it, I thought, well, this, I don't know how it would work as an actual book, but it does work well as an audio book because you've got different voices telling the story. So a bit more interesting than a standard biography format. And it allows you to see things from more than one perspective. And I really like that in biography. And biography, autobiography, it's a tricky genre, really, because certainly autobiography is entirely biased, isn't it? Is it fact? Is it what the author would like you to think of their life? I mean, Brian Blessed's autobiography is absolutely hilarious. I love Brian. So this is interesting because I think it allows you to get a very rounded picture.
You talk about biography and autobiography. I had never really thought of it as biography. I thought of it as it's a work of fiction. That's what it is. But it includes biographical details about Lincoln and about the environment. But within those details, there's often contradictions because some of the sources quoted, I mean, I'm thinking of one section where it says, well, that big party during which the son was lying upstairs ill and he was going to die very soon. And the parents, Abraham Lincoln and his wife, were popping upstairs, downstairs, upstairs, downstairs. Afterwards, various people said,
in several accounts of the evening, the brilliance of the moon is remarked upon.
In Long Road to Glory by Edward Holt.
A common feature of these narratives is the golden moon, hanging quaintly above the scene.
In White House Soirees, an anthology by Bernadette Yvonne.
There was no moon that night, and the sky was heavy with clouds.
Wicket opposite.
And you think, hang on, this is the way biography works. Because what the author is doing is drawing on a multitude of sources. I mean, some of them are unpublished notes and diaries from servants who worked at the White House at the time. And putting all those together and coming up with a multifaceted picture, and you don't quite know what's true and what isn't true.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter because it's within a context that itself is fictional.
It's really clever, isn't it? It's a structure that is, it's intriguing.
You could easily give up after one section or less listening to it. You think, crikey, I'm not going to get a run at this. It keeps interrupting by saying where that bit's come from, where that bit's come from. That sort of goes off after a while. In the beginning, with these characters who are in limbo land, you have to have them identified because you don't really know who they are. Otherwise, there are two or three of them. There's the Reverend Science, and there's I forgot the names, Bevins and something else, who are all there in this dreadful period, but they don't want to move on into the other world, the next world. They're stuck in this period of time, but they're also stuck there of their own volition because they could go, and we see during the book the situations where people do go, this magical flashing of light and everything else, and they go on. But they're very concerned about young Willie Lincoln because he should not be there for more than a very short time because children shouldn't hang around in the Bardo. They should go on. And they want to do everything possible to get him out of there, out of the sarcophagus in which he is sitting looking at his own body. They're not in coffins, of course. They're all in sick boxes. Wonderful phrase which they use, because they will not admit to the fact they're dead. They fell sick. They were put into a sick box. They were taken to this place. And they don't understand it almost why they're still there. Some of the characters that are stuck in this place are not very pleasant. And some of them are quite offensive. Some of them are very offensive to each other, very painful, hurtful to each other, bringing with them all sorts of problems. And I think that's what's so interesting, is that every character brings from the real world the history.
And that day, alas, was the day of the beam. Yes, yes, what luck. A beam from the ceiling came down, hitting me just here, as I sat at my desk. And so our plan must be deferred while I recovered. Per the advice of my physician, I took to my... a sort of sick box, was judged to be...
Hans Vollmann.
Efficacious.
Roger Bevins III.
Efficacious, yes. Thank you, friend.
Always a pleasure.
There I lay in my sick box, feeling foolish in the parlor, the very parlor through which we had recently, gleefully, guiltily, her hand in mine, passed en route to her bedroom. Then the physician returned, and his assistants carried my sick box to his sick cart, and I saw that our plan must be indefinitely delayed. What a frustration!
The mother who had three daughters, who she talks about them endlessly, and they float around as orbs. Mm. And then one day, the characters that we are most often with in the Bardo, they realise those orbs are empty, and they realise that the mother has actually gone to the next world. And sometimes there's a sort of a huge event. There's like a wind howling, and then a rushing of water, and that means there's another gang of them coming from somewhere else, and these are spirits attacking. It sounds very odd.
It is odd, but it's interesting, isn't it? Because so many books are about ghosts, children, often, who are stuck between worlds. And I think this is the first book I've read that explores that other world. I don't know. This is a deep question, really, Rob. Do you think that's possible? I wouldn't rule it out. I don't know.
No idea. We all have different concepts of what might happen after we've died. Yeah. But the idea of purgatory and limbo has been quite common throughout history. Mm. It's still there now, this idea that there is something between life and full death, as it were. Mm. And that can be a formative moment, that you either go one way or t'other. But this is done in such a human way. There is a lot of humour in it as well, yes. Of course. Some of the characters. They sort of, they're on the make. There are crooks and there are villains, and they remain that way. And that's why they're dead in many cases. I mean, one of the characters is there because a beam fell on his head just as he was about to go back to his wife. But he thinks, at that point, I'm only in a sick box. I'm going to get better. They just put me in a sick box because that's what they do. But it's because we know he's dead. It's a coffin. Young Willie is there, and if he sits still for too long, then the arms, like the roots of trees, will come round him and they will seal him into this sarcophagus unless he's got out. And the other three characters that are running around here trying to look after him actually break him out of that several times by forcing these tendrils, or whatever the right word is.
My father was here and has promised to return, the boy said. I am trying to last. All best wishes with that, said Mr. Lippert, raising an eyebrow. Mind your leg there, kiddo, said Mr. Kane. Distracted by our guests, we had been remiss. The boy's left leg was now webbed to the roof by several stout new tendrils, each the width of a wrist. Goodness, the boy said, blushing. The labor required to get him free was not insignificant, roughly equivalent to that required to uproot a tangle of blackberry roots. He bore the considerable discomfort of that procedure with a soldierly fixity of mind for one so young, letting out only a stoic grunt at each tug, and then, exhausted, fell back into that earlier state of disassociated torpor.
The spirit of him, not the body, because that's still there in the sick box. And when Lincoln comes back to the graveyard, very, very sad and very tragic, and that's, again, historically true, that he did go and apparently would sit by the grave of his son. These three characters, they lead us through the Bardo all the time, that the Reverend and his two friends, who are there for different reasons, they try to get Lincoln to get his son to go on, to move on. And the only way they can do that is to enter into him.
In order to occupy the greatest percentage of the gentleman's volume, I lowered myself into his lap and sat cross-legged, just as he was sitting.
The two now comprised one sitting man, Mr. Volman's great girth somewhat overflowing the gentleman, his massive member existing wholly outside the gentleman, pointing up at the moon.
It was quite something. Quite something in there. Bivens, come in, I called out. This is not to be missed.
I went in, assuming the same cross-legged posture.
And the three of us were one.
So to speak.
There's Lincoln sitting, and one of them climbs into his lap and goes into it, and the other one climbs onto his lap and goes into it. So there are three of them in the same body, and they're trying to communicate in some way with Lincoln to get his son to go on, to let his son be dead, because Lincoln doesn't want his son to be dead. And that's part of the trick, I think.
Yeah, it's so sad, isn't it? One can't help identifying with that. I mean, we're both parents, aren't we? And focusing on that part of the book, it's a very, very sad book. And it's not what I thought the book would be about because I hadn't read the back. I certainly didn't know it was going to go off on this magical mystery tour. Now, this is where you're at an advantage reading a book. When you're listening to a book, you get distracted easily, you see. And I did, cooking the dinner, walking along, seeing someone I know. And it's really hard to pick up again. So I didn't get everything from this book that you got.
I've listened to it in the car on long journeys. So I've listened to it in bits as well. And that I've noticed that I've lost track of where I am. I didn't find that a disadvantage. And that may be because I'd read the book first, as it were. But I felt that it almost didn't matter if you missed sections of it. Because the whole thing is so sort of compulsively multidimensional that it sticks with you and you think, well, it didn't matter, I can't remember where I was. You're given these guidelines of the voice says, you know, it's not chapters, it's 35.
Yeah, that's true.
Some of them are very short, page or two long only. And then you're sort of led through it. And I don't think it matters too much. It isn't as if it's a long narrative which you miss bits of, because it's actually lots of different characters coming in with different elements and groups of characters. The men with the hats, I can't remember what they're called, and various other things, the wedding parties and all sorts of things that come in. You get a whole social context.
So what you mean, Rob, is it's a very confusing book whether you read it or not.
I don't think it's confusing. I don't think it. Well, okay, maybe I'm a peculiar sort of reader. Yes, but I like challenge. Yes, I agree. It's not a book for everyone. It's not an audiobook for everyone. But I honestly would say it is a challenging and ultimately fascinating and rewarding.
It is. I'm really glad I read it. Wouldn't have chosen to. Didn't know what I was getting into. And that's hard for sighted people to understand. Because if you go into a bookshop or a library, judgments you will make about really what the book looks like, the artwork, and maybe if you've read something by that author before. But we really do come into these things blind. So yeah, it wasn't what I was expected. It was a really interesting structure. I didn't learn very much about Abraham Lincoln, but of course that wasn't really the point.
Absolutely. It uses biographical details and questions them all the time as part of the context in which the real story, which is this child in the Bardo and all the things that are going on around that. Lincoln is important because he's the cause of it. And of course, he keeps dropping back into the Civil War and the context of what's going on within American life at that time.
As the dead piled up in unimaginable numbers and sorrow was added to sorrow, a nation that had known little of sacrifice blamed Lincoln for a dithering mismanagement of the war effort.
In The Unpopular Mr. Lincoln, the story of America's most reviled president by Larry Tagg.
The president is an idiot.
In The Civil War Papers of George B. McClellan, edited by Stephen Sears.
Vain, weak, puerile, hypocritical, without manners, without social grace, and as he talks to you, punches his fists under your ribs.
In The War Years by Carl Sandburg, account of Sherrard Clemens.
I think autobiography and biography are very interesting concepts, and I think it works really well having those different viewpoints rather than one. I mean, some biographers do use different sources, don't they? But I really like the voices in the audiobook. There are some wonderful speakers there. Nick Offerman with his lovely, rich tone.
So there's lots and lots of different voices. It really is challenging to listen to, just as it's challenging to read. Mm. It's his first novel, I believe, because he's a short story writer who's spent all his life writing short stories.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because I can see that now you mention it. It is a series of very, very short stories, isn't it? With a sort of theme.
A lot of people kept saying to him, when are you going to write a novel? When are you going to write a novel? Well, he finally did.
Well, I really like short stories, actually. I wish we celebrated them more. Mm. There's an amazing skill in being able to get interesting character development, good use of language and other literary devices within a very short story. Yeah. And I do think we should...
We should come back to short stories because it's very much in the moment. It's very popular at the moment. There is a sort of resurgence of short story writing around. Great. George Saunders, not Sanders, not to be confused with the actor George Saunders. This is George Saunders, winner of the Man Booker Prize 2017, the first American to win the prize. It's called Lincoln in the Bardo. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Lincoln in the Bardo was written by George Saunders. The audiobook, kindly provided to us by Caliber Audio so that we could take some extracts, was recorded by a total of 16 different actors. It lasts for approximately 7.5 hours. Well, I guess my enthusiasm about this book was pretty darned evident. Not an easy read nor an easy listen, but well worth it for me.
We're coming to the end of this week's programme. Thanks as ever to all our contributors, including our readers, Gilly, Caroline, Fiona and Liz. And as ever, thank you for listening. Steve will be here next week with the next edition of the News Extra programme, but that's all from me, Bill Redway, in August 2019. We close with Cotillon du Capitaine by Le Vent du Nord. I hope you enjoy it. Goodbye.